Madam Dean, Mr. President, Mr. Provost, Bill, Jim, Marilyn, the choir, and all of you. This is an unusual honor for me and a great, great personal pleasure to be with you on the inauguration of this historic new Chair of Baptist Studies. I just want to say that knowing Jim Dunn as I do, I hope this is not just a chair you can sit on, but one you can stand on and jump up and down. Because I hope that's what happens in this chair. I also want to bring all of you today greetings to one of the youngest divinity schools in America from what is still the oldest. Harvard College was founded in 1636, as the charter says, to educate ministers so that when our present ministers shall lie in the dust, we shall not have to bear the curse of an ignorant clergy. They put it really strongly in those days. But I'm afraid we have not completely escaped the curse of ignorant clergy, or ignorant lay people, for that matter. And my hope is that this historic chair will help us in all those respects. I want to talk today about what I have chosen to call the Baptist motif. I take that idea from my great theological teacher, Paul Tillich, who coined the term Protestant principle. That is the capacity granted, given by God for criticism and indeed self-criticism, which he matched with what he called the Catholic substance, Protestant principle and Catholic substance. Tillich further said that although the Protestant principle had emerged with the Hebrew prophets and had come to forceful institutional expression in the Protestant Reformation, it had virtually disappeared from modern Protestantism, but had immigrated to other movements and often surfaced in them, the Protestant principle. Now, I use the word motif here in part because sometimes the word principle is seems a little too rigid. A motif, as it's defined, is a trope or a figure, often used in music or literature, which can appear in various different nuanced expressions once it is stated. It can be expanded, enlarged, with harmonic variations. And I want to say that the Baptist motif, what I'm calling the Baptist motif, just like the Protestant principle, emerged at a certain point in history, namely with what we call the left wing of the Protestant Reformation, with the Anabaptists and later the Baptists, very strongly, forcefully, but that it has sometimes disappeared from our history, but it has not disappeared completely. And we have, as Baptists, no monopoly on this Baptist principle of what Roger Williams called soul liberty. Soul liberty, religious freedom. I want to further say that we need it desperately today in the world and in America, and that we are in danger of losing it. Let me start with Roger Williams. As a New Englander and a Baptist, I've had a long-standing love affair with Roger Williams. A wonderful and interesting man. He arrived in 1631 at the Massachusetts Bay Colony, where I still live, although it's not a colony anymore. And by the way, it's the home of the New England Patriots. He was a brilliant man, had gone to Cambridge, learned Latin, Greek, Hebrew, and French. When he came to Massachusetts Bay, he was awarded the plum of ministerial appointments, namely the Boston Church. But Roger Williams refused to accept that assignment. Why? Because the Boston church had not fully separated from the fallen and sinful Church of England, which was still officially headed by the King of England. He would have none of it. So he went off to a small separatist congregation in Plymouth, where he served, and the Puritan officials in Massachusetts Bay tried to ignore him. He was seen as something between a bother and a pest, but maybe they could tolerate him, since Plymouth was a long way from Massachusetts Bay at the time. Then, however, Roger Williams stepped over the line. He began to publicly criticize the Royal Charter, which was the legal basis for the colony. Why? Because he said the king has absolutely no right to expropriate the land of the indigenous people and to hand it over to English settlers. No right whatever. Every square inch on which the settlers were living should be fairly purchased from the Wampanoags or the Narragansetts. So with this bold move, Williams had veered beyond mere ecclesial disputes. He had threatened the very foundation of the Bay Colony's claim to legality. This was no longer soul freedom as far as the Puritan officials were concerned. This was getting close to treason. So they ordered him to leave the colony forthwith. However, Williams, still in Plymouth, of course, showed no indication that he was packing his bags. And the officials lost patience and sent out a posse to arrest him, put him on a ship, and send him back to England, where he would undoubtedly have been arrested and probably executed. He was warned by friends that the posse was on the way. He fled out into the teeth of a blizzard, into the thick forest, where his advocacy, however, for the indigenous people helped him, because they came to his aid and sheltered him through the winter until he could settle down further south outside of the colony's jurisdiction. There he founded a city called Providence, because he believed he'd been guided and safeguarded by Providence, divine Providence. He also founded a new colony called Rhode Island, and he insisted that all peoples of all religious persuasions would be welcome into the Rhode Island colony. Toleration is too weak a term for Roger Williams. He wanted all people to come there, and indeed, it became a refuge for all kinds of dissidents, including the Quaker, famous Quaker Anne Hutchinson. They moved to Rhode Island. Meanwhile, the Puritans at Massachusetts Bay sneered on Rhode Island as what they called, and Bill Leonard will recognize this phrase, the cesspool of New England. But it had a reputation for freedom of religion, which attracted Jews, later Roman Catholics. And it is no surprise that the very first Jewish settlement in North America was in Rhode Island, and that the oldest synagogue in North America is still there in Rhode Island, at Truro. So I have to ask myself, where did the young Roger Williams get this passion for soul liberty? Where did it come from? And again, I think there was something very Baptist. He combined his learning, his respect for learning and scholarship, with allowing his experience to make a deep and lasting impact. He read Milton's Areopagitica in college, but one day, while he was still in England, he saw a dissenter being branded on the cheek with the letters S, standing for sower of sedition. These two sources motivated the young Roger Williams to be a courageous battler throughout his life for what he called soul liberty. And he had a revulsion that anyone, church or state, should impose any kind of religious belief or ban any kind of religious belief, which he called soul rape. Well, his new colony had rocky beginnings. The Massachusetts Bay Colony were exasperated that Roger Williams was just over the border. So they tried to annex Rhode Island. But Roger Williams traveled back to England, got a charter for a separate colony there, Rhode Island. He wrote the charter for the new colony of Rhode Island, declaring again that all people of all spiritual persuasions, bar none, were to have complete religious liberty. Williams included in his own writing this phrase. This should include, he says, quote, Papists, Jews, Protestants, and Turks. Now, Papist was the not too nice term people used in those days for Roman Catholics. Turks meant any Muslim. They called them then Mohammedans. This was a wide open invitation. It is sometimes called, that charter is sometimes called the Magna Carta of religious freedom in the whole world. It was not long after the charter was enacted that Williams decided that the christening of children, as he put it, quote, does not a Christian make, unquote, and declared himself to be a Baptist. Consistent reasoning. Baptizing infants, he thought, was a form of religious coercion. These poor, coddly little children had not given consent to be baptized. So he founded a congregation, and that congregation still stands there in Providence, Rhode Island, and it is called the First Baptist Church of America. Sorry, all you Southern Baptists, it didn't start in Nashville or Louisiana. It started in Providence, Rhode Island. Now, Williams is fairly well known for a lot of these things. However, there are a couple things about him that aren't as well known, which I think are worth mentioning. While he was still living in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, he bridled under the practice of the administrators there, the magistrates, of handing out large tracts of land to settlers who arrived there already with considerable wealth and social status. He hated that idea. So in Rhode Island, he began handing out these tracts of land that he had purchased from the Indians to all who came, regardless of their previous social setting. He did become a magistrate. He became the chief magistrate of Rhode Island, and that makes me glad that at one point our Baptist forebears did separate themselves in a friendly way from their other Anabaptist colleagues, the Mennonites, Quakers, for example, and said that indeed Baptists could and should hold public office as a magistrate. Where would we have been? Where would Harry Truman and Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter have been if as Baptists they couldn't have held public life? I'm glad they made that choice. Now Roger Williams was a theological thinker. And there are embedded in some of his thinking, there are embedded some ideas which have only recently, I think, come to more visible fruition and are very important today. And I want to mention two of them. First of all, the idea of separation of church and state, soul liberty, is a recognition at its basis, that in order to bring a constructive critique to bear on any society, one must be rooted in the community that is not enclosed in that society. Robert Bella, another one of my teachers, has recently pointed this out beautifully in his new book called Religion and Human Evolution. He reminds us that previous to the Hebrew prophets in the Middle East, the governing pattern was what he calls cosmological. The king and the priest all ruled together, a single cosmological structure. Then came, the pharaoh in Egypt is the principal example. All others were very much like that. Then, however, came a historic breakthrough, what some have called an axial age, in which the prophets had a separate community, and they believed that the people had a covenant with God, directly with God, not through the king. The king was no longer the channel for God. God had given the people a covenant. They were grounded in that covenant. And therefore, they had a place to stand in order to stand up against the king. And they did. The history of the Bible, the story of the Bible, is the story of Samuel standing up against Saul, prophets standing up against kings throughout all of its history. There were always tensions between the prophets and the kings. The prophets were not the spokespeople of the king, of the royal authority. They spoke for God. That's the story of Israel. That's, in a nutshell, that is the story in the Bible, culminating for Christians, of course, with Jesus' confrontation with Pilate, the embodiment of a royal cosmic religious order. Now, be careful to realize, however, that the realms are separated, not so that they can inhabit different spheres, but so that one can bring the power from one to bear on the other. So that when Jesus says, "My kingdom is not of this world," he doesn't mean that his kingdom has nothing to do with this world. He means that the community, the message that he embodies, cannot be enclosed by this world. He must and we must speak truth to power. That's the first insight, enormously important insight, into Roger Williams' notion of soul freedom and separation of church and state. The second is even more interesting, I think, for our time, and that is that since anyone could be welcome to Rhode Island, when Williams eventually left the Baptist fold, I forgot to mention that, he did, after a while, decide that even the Baptists were a little bit too confining. Maybe not the first person to come to that conviction. He styled himself a seeker and even suggested in some of his late correspondence that God, not only should the Turks and the Papists be welcome to Rhode Island, but God could very well be present in them. He went way beyond religious tolerance to something else. Now, it seems a little ungenerous to say anything critical about Roger Williams, so I'm only going to say one small thing because he's still one of my great heroes. Somehow or another, I wish he would have connected his idea of soul freedom with his obvious passion for justice, like that redistribution, like the way land, which was the source of wealth in those days, of course, was to be distributed in Rhode Island and not given to a 1% at the top, so to speak. He has a somewhat individualistic view, although he breaks out of it, but he doesn't tell us what the connection is at times. Maybe that's expecting too much. However, I think it has to be said that for Baptists, individualism has often been our Achilles heel. Harold Bloom, in his very unsatisfactory book, in part, it's called The American Religion, has a chapter in it about Baptists, which is a little painful to read, was for me. He says, for many Baptists, the ideal is to be alone in the garden with Jesus. Ours can be a religion, he contends, in which the world can easily evaporate into a kind of Gnosticism. Now, I say painful because I think we all recognize a certain element of truth in this statement, although he may overstate it. And as I read that, I remembered a song that all of us sang in Sunday school. I won't ask the choir to sing it now, but you know it and I know it. I come to the garden alone while the dew is still on the roses, and he talks with me, and he walks with me, and he tells me I am his own. Now, if you think about it a little bit, what was Jesus doing in the garden? Let's say it was the Garden of Gethsemane. He wasn't there very long alone. He was there to consult in prayer with God about his next confrontation with the corrupt power represented by the temple and the Roman occupation. He knew that he was the object of a search party. He knew he needed help, not to stay in the garden, but to leave the garden, to go forth into his ministry. He wasn't alone very long. He was accosted by a posse with spears and clubs. The dew on the roses was soon trampled by leather boots. And this moves me to the second of the prophets of the Baptist motif. I'll devote a little less time, although I am also very fond of him, and namely Martin Luther King Jr. I think the two go together. They complement each other in the two foci of what I've called the Baptist motif, which is the soul liberty and what King called the beloved community. The beloved community. What really irks me when I hear, when the Martin Luther King holiday rolls around, surely one of the great towering figures of our time, is that he was not just a civil rights leader. I don't think you can possibly understand Martin Luther King Jr. unless you realize that he was born and bred and born again and lived and died a Baptist, indeed a Baptist minister. I remember being especially infuriated watching television the night that he was assassinated. Camera was trained on the Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem, and a completely clueless commentator was saying, of course the people there are mourning the death of Dr. King. Why, his father was a Baptist minister. His father? Yes, his father and his grandfather, but Martin Luther King, I think, is totally inexplicable without understanding where he is coming from, namely his roots in the Black Baptist Church, his vision of the beloved community, another way of saying the kingdom of God. Now, why is King so badly misunderstood, even on his holiday? He's even said at times he left his pulpit to become a civil rights leader. Martin Luther King never left his pulpit. His pulpit went with him wherever he was, into jail cells, into decaying urban slums, into the halls of governance. He was always there as a minister, teaching and preaching and witnessing for the gospel. Why is he so misunderstood? I think the first is the people who write these documentaries don't know anything about Baptists or Baptist history. One of the reasons why this chair is such a welcome addition. And alas, most Baptists don't know very much about Baptist history. Our ignorance is sometimes appalling. The other reason why King is not recognized, I think, is as a Baptist minister for what he did, is that many Baptists, North and South, were conspicuously and vigorously against what he was doing in his ministry. They didn't understand what sustained him. We know what sustained him because he's told us in some of his writings. He's sitting at the kitchen table, his own Gethsemane, the night after yet another attempt to bomb his home. And God spoke to him, he says, at about 2:30 in the morning and said, "Martin, I will never, no, never leave you alone." I've heard that cited, you have too, many times, but very few people know it's a quotation from the Gospel of John, John 11:28. And it's a line from a hymn that Martin Luther King certainly sang, "O Lord God Almighty." King was sustained by what he called cosmic allies and his belief, as he said, that the history of the universe is bent toward justice. So both Martin Luther King and Roger Williams were marked early in their lives by both the great tradition of the Bible, the theology, but also by suffering and discrimination. King lived his life in the Jim Crow world of pre-civil rights America. Roger Williams lived his early life under the cruel punishment and persecution of the establishment of England. There are some differences between them, but I think they complement each other. Williams emphasized soul liberty. King emphasized the beloved community. And the Baptist motif includes both. And it includes both because you need one for the other. You need to draw on the freedom you have as a Christian, the community that you have, which is your ultimate loyalty, in order to speak constructively and critically to power in the secular realm. Now, I'm grateful that we have in the 20th century such other people who have combined this, people like James Dunn, people like Walter Rauschenbusch, Bill Leonard, Bill Moyers, and others, who understand that these two go together. That the Baptist motif not only permits, it requires Christians not to tarry forever in the garden, but to go forth to wear across the crowded ways of life. I'm grateful for both Roger Williams and for Martin Luther King and for many others who've contributed to our tradition. And I want to stop now and point out one further thing about Williams in this case that I think is especially urgent for us today. I go back to his phrase, that delicious little phrase, "Protestants, Papists, and Turks." He didn't think Baptists were Protestants, by the way. That's what I was taught, too, in the Sunday school. There are Catholics, Protestants, and Baptists. So I resonate with that. Think about the Papists. Now, we don't... He insisted on welcoming them to the Rhode Island colony. This was only a couple decades, I remind you, after the Spanish Armada had tried to dethrone the Queen of England and install a Catholic monarch. It was only a few years after Guy Fawkes and his compatriots had been found trying to blow up Parliament with gunpowder. In other words, Papists were the international religious terrorists of the day. All the other colonies banned them until Maryland was opened up eventually for them. They all banned them. But Roger Williams said, no, as long as they obey the civil law, they are welcome to Long Island. International religious terrorists. Now, we no longer think of Catholics as international terrorists, but many people here and also in Europe think that way about Muslims. People of Murfreesboro, Tennessee, for example, have succeeded, many of them Baptists, I fear, in preventing a mosque from being built in their town. And you all know about the Reverend Terry Jones of Florida, who said he would burn 200 Qurans and wanted to initiate a national Burn the Quran Day. So how are those of us who still are motivated by this Baptist motif, how are we supposed to respond to the current threats? The answer seems self-evident, that the test of soul liberty is not whether we insist on it for ourselves, but whether we insist on it for everyone, and especially for those with whom we disagree. Williams disagreed, basically, with Catholics, with papists, but he welcomed them. Further, I think, we have to realize that as the Baptist motif is repeated, as it reappears in the great symphony of history, there'll be variations. There'll be new harmonies. Who will be the new Roger Williams? Maybe a graduate of this school. Who will be the new Martin Luther King? Or Martha King, perhaps? Or Rachel Williams? Who will they be? Will we recognize them as being in continuity with this great tradition? So I'm grateful to be here with you today and to make the wonderful tie-in the dean made between the chair I have the honor of holding, which was funded by an English Baptist, under the condition that anyone occupying this chair should not be subjected to any creedal test. Now, that was early 1700s. I like the connection between that first chair and this first chair. I welcome it. But I also would like to say that not only must we vigilantly protect religious freedom, we must draw on that freedom to confront the injustice of our world and to strive toward the beloved community. So congratulations, Wake Forest. Congratulations, Jim Dunn and Marilyn. And congratulations, Bill Leonard. Let us be on our way. Thank you.